Welcome to the DTP podcast for April 2024, volume 62, number 4. My name's David Fazakerly. I'm DTP's deputy editor.
Hello, I'm James Cave, editor-in-chief.
Once again, thank you for joining us for this podcast. We are recording this in the first week of March. And before we get to the detail of April's issue, I know, James, you wanted to raise a medication safety issue that you spotted, was it in a newspaper last weekend? What was the story?
Yes, this is something that was in The Observer. And it just picked up that the MHRA has just announced that it's doing a further review of montelukast, which, as you all know, is a leukotriene receptor antagonist called Singulair. And they're saying that they've identified further concerns about it. And it just reminded me that this is a drug that we used to think of as being really without any sting in the tail at all. And then in 2019, the MHRA warned us about these quite unusual neuropsychiatric reactions that some children can have. And the sort of reactions which you might not connect with a medication, particularly things like stuttering, some obsessive compulsive symptoms. And I just thought it was worthwhile just raising this because I think, as we're going to discuss later, regulatory safety warnings sometimes fall on stony ground. Now, we don't know what the outcome of this MHRA further review is going to be, but I think the article in The Observer suggested that about 350,000 patients take montelukast. And so this may be something that's just worth remembering and actually making sure that if you do prescribe it in asthma, and it still sits on the asthma guidelines, that you just suggest that parents read the insert and are aware of the possible neuropsychiatric reactions, particularly because actually it sounds like the symptoms usually quickly resolve on stopping the drug. So this is not something which needs to be a major issue. You know, it should be quite simple to work out what's going on by stopping it.
Yeah, I had a quick look at the MHRA summary of adverse drug reaction reports for montelukast. I think it's been around since 98, but they had a total of 3,274 reports, of which 1,876 were serious, 25 were fatal, and a total of nearly 8,000 reactions. But almost 3,000 of those were psychiatric disorders. And I suppose at the serious end, 151 of those were related to suicide and self-injury. So, as you say, it's not without its problems. And yes, the prescribing data suggests something like 4.5 million primary care prescriptions dispensed in England in 23. So a lot of it about. I was slightly surprised when I heard that the MHRA were doing another review because I haven't seen anything on their website or any alert from them about this. So I don't know whether this was a journalist asking them. Do you know where that story came from?
I think there is now, my understanding, reading the article, is there is a pressure group now with about 3,500 members. And I just wonder whether they've been lobbying, and I just wonder whether they've had a response from an agency suggesting that's going on. As I say, I've not seen it anywhere else, but it is something clearly that perhaps is on the radar.
I mean, I did pick up a drug safety newsletter from Ireland that was published at the end of last year that said the EMA are also looking at it and thinking of adding another warning. But again, I couldn't see anything on their site either since really the 2019 warning. So it'd be interesting to monitor this and see what happens. Mm. I mean, just get your thoughts. You know, if you were going to be prescribing montelukast today, what would you be saying to either a patient or parents of a younger patient?
I'm going to praise you this because it's never been a drug that I've particularly used. I think there have been times when it's been useful in patients who find taking or using inhalers difficult. And obviously it has, you know, that is one of its advantages, is that it's a pill, it's a tablet, actually it's a chewable tablet as well. So actually from concordance, it can be quite helpful, but I've never found it a drug that's made a significant difference to my management. But if I was, I think you'd just say, look, you know, there is this issue around these quite unusual symptoms, read the insert and just report back to me if, you know, you feel that any of this is going on so that we can take a look at it and probably stop it, have a drug holiday and see if it is related to the medication itself.
And as you say, you know, probably easy to miss, isn't it, that you, a treatment for a respiratory problem, you're probably not anticipating anything that's either neuropsychiatric or anything to do with mental health. So, yes, it's a good reminder, and it's kind of a theme of I think of today's podcast. So, the idea of medicine safety and needing to pick up on these things kind of runs through a couple of the items we want to talk about. So let's move seamlessly on to editorial written by Barbara Mintzes about medicine safety issues. What's her argument in her editorial?
Yeah, as you say, this rather nicely leads on to her editorial, where she's asking, you know, do regulatory safety warnings actually have enough impact? She points out that actually when a drug comes to market, often it's had actually very, very little in the way of information about safety data. I'm always reminded of the rule of three, which says that, you know, if you want to detect an adverse event in a drug with a 95%, you know, clarity that you're going to see that adverse effect, you've got to have three times the number of patients in the trial than the incidence of that adverse effect. So if you have a 1 in 100 incidence of something harmful, to be 95% sure that you will see that in that trial, you've got to have 300 patients. And yet, as Barbara points out in her editorial, the median number of patients involved in pre-market studies of drugs licensed in the USA for the 12 years between 2002 and 2014 was just 1,044. So that means any side effect with an incidence of 1 in 300 or less is likely to be perhaps missed in those pre-market trials. And so, you know, Andrew Herxheimer was always very clear, you know, the one thing you don't know about a drug when it first comes to market is its side effect profile. And she points out, therefore, it's really important that we have a really good post-market regulatory system to advise clinicians about safety alerts. And she points out that, you know, it can take a long time sometimes for things, adverse effects of drugs to be found. So, for example, the example she gives is Omicor, which has just been noted to have an issue around atrial fibrillation, has only just been highlighted, and yet that drug has been licensed for over 20 years. We've got all the fluoroquinolones, you know, the ciprofloxacin drugs and their issues with irreversible harm. You know, that's something which has come out of the middle quite late. So, you know, it's really important that we have these. And yet, in a systematic review that looked at 25 advisories on prescribing, it found that actually at 12 months, there'd only been a 34% relative reduction in the use of the drug. And in those regulatory letters to doctors or warnings where they were just raising awareness, there'd only been an 11% change in behavior. So she quite rightly asks, you know, are they good enough? And, you know, what can we do to make this better? Because it's obviously a very important thing, particularly at this time, I think, in the regulatory cycle with the plans to bring drugs much, much more quickly to market and get them being used in a much faster way.
And I guess the challenge is, isn't it, we know from kind of evidence and past experience that if you just send information to people, it doesn't tend to change their practice, or it takes a long time for it to have any noticeable effect on practice. So I guess we shouldn't be too surprised that the issuing of a drug safety update or a Dear Healthcare Professional letter on their own isn't going to produce a huge shift in what people do. And unless, I guess, the thing is so significant that people take fright. But generally, single interventions don't do a lot.
No, and I think, you know, we've been perhaps, you know, in a previous podcast, we've talked about this. You know, the MHRA might give out a warning. You're left thinking, well, what do I do with this? And of course, a lot of drugs these days are taken long term. So you might, as a clinician, decide today that you're no longer going to prescribe a drug, but you might well have a significant number of patients who are already taking that drug, and actually stopping that and finding an alternative is a whole different task. So sometimes I think there does need to be much more clarity about exactly what is expected. And I think she actually talks about a Danish study that looked at advisories from Danish health regulation advisory boards issued between 2007 and 2018, which recommended patients were monitored. But actually only 11% of these advisories actually offered adequate instructions about what the thresholds were and how often you should monitor, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it is a difficult one. And I think I can understand why these medical health agencies find it difficult, because they're not clinicians, and therefore it's difficult for them to know how they should advise clinicians what they're doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think probably the MHRA would argue it's not up to that. They're providing the information. It's not up to them necessarily to tell you how to change your clinical practice. But I do agree that there is a lack of specificity about some of these alerts that say leave you scratching your head sometimes and thinking, well, so what? I think the good thing is, and Barbara quotes it, doesn't she, that there was that example from many years ago. Do you remember when the warning around cardiovascular concerns over non-steroidals came out, and there was a review published and then a safety alert about the risks of things like diclofenac and cardiovascular events? And when it first appeared, virtually no change in prescribing happened. But what then followed was a series of, and I think it was the National Prescribing Centre that put them in place, a kind of coordinated program of seminars, educational materials and local initiatives that actually helped people implement a change. And then you did see a reduction in prescribing. So I suppose it's just a good reminder that you do need a multifaceted approach led by some organisation. And if it's not the MHRA, then it needs to be somebody that actually picks these up and says, right, this is important. These are the steps you need to take to make it happen. And these are the individual elements of a programme that will help prescribing change. But I don't know who does that now.
I agree. And I think the non-steroidal was particularly interesting because we had some lovely systematic reviews, I think it was, where you had a number needed to treat and numbers needed to harm. And it was very clear as a clinician when you then were going to discuss whether they should have their Voltarol. You know, this is the risk compared with if I was to try naproxen or a low-dose ibuprofen. So there was definitely something you could use as a clinician when you discuss it with patients. And I think that's the difficult thing, is that very often these are drugs that patients are taking because they want to take them. And if you're going to say, I think you should stop taking them, or I think we need to alter things, just saying that there's a sort of nebulous warning without some understanding of the figures. And, you know, we are being strongly urged in every other aspect of our clinical life that we should be using patient decision aids and actually making decisions with patients. And I think we need the same approach when it comes to when we start to be concerned about safety. We need to be able to quantify and qualify that for patients so they can make that decision with you.
Yes, indeed. And I think the other interesting thing about the editorial is, as Barbara notes at the end of it, that some regulators come to different decisions from other regulators. You know, what one regulator might say about a medicine safety, another one might not. And then there is always a risk of confusion in that as well. So, I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. And this isn't a criticism necessarily of the MHRA for its approach. It's just saying it takes more than a safety alert, doesn't it, to make a change in practice.
Totally. I think that's right. And I think it's incumbent on us as clinicians to make sure that we look at them. And I think probably that, you know, I would actually say as a clinician, you know, if you get a safety alert that you don't understand, you need to go away and see if you can understand it. I think that is incumbent on us as clinicians. You know, we're prescribers, you know, we deal with some dangerous drugs. And if we've just been warned that this drug is even more dangerous, it's incumbent on us to go away. And I've emailed the MHRA a number of occasions to ask them for more details. And sometimes you get some important, interesting stuff, and sometimes you don't. But I just think you should put yourself in a position where you've done your best to know what's going on.
And as I say, we will continue to highlight the ones that we think are important and put some context around them. So let's thank you for that. Let's again swing into another aspect of this. And here's a good example of a safety alert that is in its, I don't know which iteration of version we're up to now. But once again, we're on the valproate story. Do you want to pick up the latest?
Yeah, I mean, it's perfect, isn't it? This is an example where the ratchet is being turned. So I think this is a third or even fourth MHRA warning regarding valproate. And it's just worth reminding ourselves that 1 in 10 children born to a mother taking valproate will have a birth defect, and 1 in 3 will have some sort of neurodevelopmental delay. And, you know, it's really important. And I think what happened was in November 2023, the MHRA public assessment report raised concerns that despite the earlier regulations put in place around valproate and the importance of a risk assessment in women particularly, that these regulations were not being followed. So this is a ratcheting up of their regulations. And the big issue now is that valproate should not be started in new patients, male or female, younger than 55 years of age, unless two specialists independently consider and document that there is no other effective or tolerated treatment, or there are compelling reasons that the reproductive risks do not apply. So it's a very tight set of criteria now. And so they're saying also that that's for new cases, and current patients should switch to a different medication at their annual review, unless once again, two specialists independently consider and document that there is no other effective or tolerated treatment. So this is really trying to ratchet down the use of valproate, well, in particular to reduce the adverse impact of this drug on unborn children.
And what I suppose what's still quite shocking is the looking at that report that NHS England published, is still a significant number of pregnancies occurred where women had taken valproate during that pregnancy, despite all that we know about the risk of this drug. And these risks have been known about, almost 30, 40 years?
That's right. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think I've got the numbers here. So between April 2018 and March 2023, a total of 52,000 females aged 0 to 54 were prescribed valproate on more than one occasion. And of this group, 1,218 had a record of conception since April 2018. So yeah, it just needs, obviously, and I can understand why. And there's talk also that there'll be a tightening as well, I gather, later in 2024 around the prescribing of valproate in men as well, because that can also have an impact on pregnancy. So it's an interesting one, and it shows, I think, how the MHRA is changing its warning and tightening them until hopefully there's a situation where this is a sort of, what do they call it, a non-event or a never event. But I suppose that the other side of the coin is that valproate is, for some people, a really effective drug, and it's about getting that balance, I suppose, between harms and benefits.
And just from a practical consideration, where does responsibility of, I think I know the answer to this, but where do you see responsibility for this lying? Obviously, the primary care practice is prescribing, but may not have started the drug. How do you balance that, making sure that people are have had the right advice and aren't slipping through the net? Is that your responsibility, or is it the specialist?
Well, I always believe if you write the prescription, you're responsible. So even though the MHRA is focusing heavily on the fact that this should only be prescribed by specialists and, you know, started by specialists, at the end of the day, if you're writing a prescription for valproate, you need to make sure that there has been an assessment by a specialist in the last year, that there's follow-up for that, each year. And if you don't see that, then you need to really find out what's going on, because at the end of the day, if you write a prescription, you are responsible for it.
Thank you very much. Let's finish off with our main article this month, which is overview of a new progestogen-only contraceptive pill. Do you want to tell us a bit about it and how to pronounce its name?
Yeah, so this is drospirenone, or SLYND, S-L-Y-N-D. And drospirenone it's actually derived from spironolactone. It's a drug that's got both anti-androgenic and anti-mineral corticoid action. And it's been around, and it's actually part of combined oral contraceptives. There are about four, I think, including Lucet and Tretine and Eloine. There are four, I say, combined oral contraceptives which already have drospirenone in it, but this is a new progesterone only single drospirenone 4 milligrams contraceptive. And it's big thing. It's sort of, I suppose, the thing that makes it different from the other progesterone only pills is, first of all, it's got a 24-hour, if you like, forgotten window. So if you remember within 24 hours of forgetting a pill, you're still safe. And there's some caveats, and as always, it's a complicated pattern depending on where in the cycle you are, which I'll come on to in a minute. But that 24-hour window compares with 3-hour windows for levonorgestrel and norethisterone progesterone-only pills, and 12 hours for desogestrel. So that's a positive element. It's odd in that you take it for 24 days, and then there are 4 inactive pills in each pack. So you have this sort of odd plan, and that does make the forgotten pills warning complicated depending where you are on that 28-day pack. Yes, it's a new progesterone only pill with this odd 24-day active, which we sort of, when we were writing this article, we looked to try and find out why was it that the drug has been licensed in this way. And my understanding of it, because actually it was a Sweden medicines agency that actually did the work for organizing the market authorization. And what they say is that it was an attempt to improve bleeding control and maintain estradiol concentrations at early follicular phase level to prevent estrogen deficiency. So that's the reason you don't get a 28-day active pill, basically continuing going forwards, as far as we can tell. So I don't know how much else you want to know about this pill.
I mean, it does its job. It prevents pregnancy.
Yeah, it seems to be as effective as most, although there were some concerns. We have 3 phase 3 trials, 1 from the US and 2 from the EU. And the 2 from the EU, one was a 1-year single arm study. 713 women were given drospirenone, and there was 3 pregnancies in that study, and that gave a Pearl index, which is this way that we measure the effectiveness of any contraception. Pearl index of 0.51. So that means if you have 100 women for a year taking drospirenone, there will be half a pregnancy each year. And then in the other European study, there were 858 women involved in that. That was a 9 cycle study, and it had a comparative, it was double blind, and there was a comparator which was desogestrel. And in that study, there were 5 pregnancies in the drospirenone group. So that gave us a Pearl index overall of almost 1.97. It seems to be probably as effective as other progesterone only pills. It's got a couple of annoying issues. One is the hyperkalemia issue. So because it is derived from spironolactone, it does seem to perhaps have this side effect of hyperkalemia. In all the studies, it was mild, but this is where things get complicated. The SPC, So the summary of product characteristics suggests that you check women with renal insufficiency and or if their pre-treatment potassium is in the upper reference range, that you also ought to be checking their potassium after they've been taking it in the first cycle. It just adds a complication because, you know, how many women of that age have you done a pre-treatment potassium? I personally am not going to be adding it to my armamentarium for contraception at the moment. I just think it's another complicated set of forgotten pills to try and remember. The other interesting thing is it may have a slightly higher venous thromboembolic risk because the combined oral contraceptive pills that contain drospirenone have a slightly higher venous thromboembolic risk. Now, there have not been enough studies to know whether the progesterone-only version, the drospirenone on its own, has a slightly higher risk, but it seems that that might be an issue. So, yeah, another pill. Where we go with it, I don't know. It's more expensive as well as the others, as you might expect. You'd have thought that having some anti-androgenic effect, perhaps it would be good for your skin, but actually acne seems to be a side effect as well. So there we are. It's another pill.
Okay. A couple of things that struck me. One is in the evidence, because you say there were the European studies, the American studies. The American studies always have a very different Pearl Index to the European studies. I think in theirs, far more pregnancies amongst their group than there were in the European studies. And I think the Pearl Index was something like almost 2.6 or something. So,
lots of issues. I mean, you wonder how they recruit women to the American study because only 35% of women completed the study. You know, 65% prematurely dropped out. You know, you do wonder, you know, did they go along to a clinic and someone say, oh, will you take part in a trial? Here's, you know, I don't know, here's a lollipop or here's a sweetener of some sort. And they just remarkable dropout rate, which is just, it just makes me wonder how, you know, can we really take much from that study? I mean, 65% premature dropout rate. This is a contraceptive pill that you're trying to demonstrate is effective. And I just don't know quite how you do that when you've got a study that only lasts, I think it was just a year, wasn't it? So yes, very, very different. But I gather that's often the way that US studies. The other interesting thing was the BMIs were very different between the studies. So I think the average BMI in the European studies was 23, but the average BMI in the American study was almost 29, and 60% had a BMI over 25. So, you know, is that an issue? I don't know, but you're right. The American study did have a much higher pregnancy rate.
And the other couple of things that picked up was particularly around, I think, the Swedish Medicines Agency assessment report and that question of the regime. It wasn't really convinced that that regime was particularly helpful, and I think commented that actually it might contribute to confusion and the possibility of missed pills because people didn't quite understand what the regime was trying to do. And that it didn't achieve what it was hoping to do, which was produce a reliable withdrawal bleed. So there was something about the regime, which I wonder whether they've saddled themselves with something that is actually more complicated than it needed to be.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I don't quite understand what it's all about. I can only imagine that perhaps it is. I mean, I think what's fascinating perhaps is drospirenone, my understanding, is it functions by preventing ovulation, which is unlike some progesterone-only pills which work on cervical mucus. So it could be that actually this is quite a powerful drug, and therefore there were concerns perhaps about estrogen deficiency, which is why they introduced the 4 days of hormone-free freedom. I don't know, but it you're right. It seems to add a complexity which really isn't welcome and is just going to confuse.
And the just to go back to the venous thromboembolism risk, which is, as you said, you pointed out, is we've seen it with a slightly higher risk with the combined pills. The I think the requirement of the European license is that they will have to do a post-marketing study to assess the risk. So we won't know any more until that's completed. So that's a bit of an unknown at the moment. Obviously, weren't enough concerns to prevent it being licensed, but enough concerns that they've required a post-marketing study to assess it. So again, we'll have to wait and see what that shows. So do I get the bottom line is that it won't be rapidly appearing in your formulary?
Yes. I mean, you know, it's almost five times the cost of other progesterone-only pills. And I think that it's not demonstrated at this stage anyway, any major benefit over them. In fact, you know, there may be some significant disadvantages. So yes, it won't be appearing on my formulary anytime soon whatsoever.
Okay, thank you very much for that. You can find these and all our articles on our website at dtp.bmj.com. You can find all our old podcasts there. If you fancy binge listening to several years' worth of podcasts, just click the button at the top of the webpage. If you want to get involved with DTP, please let us know. You can suggest topics, be a peer reviewer, or even help write articles. Just email us at dtp@bmj.com. Many thanks for listening, and we hope you'll be able to join us in a month's time for the May 2024 podcast.